I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Happy Halloween! Today we'll find the spooky side of Los Angeles. After an exposé revealed fraud at Southern California farmers markets, I'll look at what's being done. A culinary tour of Colombia, we'll go apple picking, plus LA's latest food celebrities are butchers. You'll meet them today on the show. But first, let's see what's in season this last week of October here in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. One of the longest time restaurants that's been operating in Santa Monica, one of the most esteemed, most famous, and most popular, is Michael's, named after its owner, chef, creator, Michael McCarty, who literally is a block away from the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market. You also have a Michael's in New York.
Correct.
And Michael is at the market now, as usual, getting inspiration for his restaurant. He's also featuring a series of dinners he calls market meetups. Great to see you here, Natalie, attired as always.
As always.
As with the hair, the bangs, the whole thing.
I have a rule out in California. I wear my linen until the end of October.
And then you segue into what fabric after Halloween?
I move into the wool, the cashmere, the wools, you see.
Good to know.
All my chefs from my New York restaurant, when they come out here, they're so jealous of how spectacular this market has always been and continues to be.
Especially on a day like this.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. So what are we cooking?
Well, we love Alec Weiser from Weiser Farms. We use him for many different things. Melons in the summer. He's always got four or five different kinds of fabulous melons that we do with a variety of hams. Mm-hmm. He's got spectacular potatoes, the peewees, every single little fingerling potato that you could imagine. But as we move into the fall menu, which we have our new menus as of last week in at Michael's in Santa Monica, one of the things that we do is we love his parsnips, and we love his Bloomsdale spinach, his sweet little spinach. It also coincides, obviously, with fabulous proteins that come into season. Like this particular one that we're working on for next week will be the Nantucket Bay scallops. Mm. The season starts November the 2nd. Every year we wait patiently. They're the size of your thumb, just the little tip of your thumb. You pan sear them very, very simply on one side only. Just get them tasty, nice, and caramelized. The natural sugars are spectacular.
Do you cook them in butter?
We cook them in butter,
okay,
as usual.
What else? Then
we do a beautiful puree, sort of like a, not quite a mash, but a little thinner, but still quite a puree of the parsnip. It's a gorgeous white on white with a little bit of the brown of the caramelization of the scallop. We also serve that with his Bloomsdale spinach, which is a beautiful organic spinach that is grown. It is very tasty. It's very gnarly. Steamed, it's spectacular. And it's a great contrast color-wise as well.
And the Bloomsdale is great because, number one, it doesn't have that oxalic acid that makes your teeth feel like they're getting soft.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I always design all my food items on their menus and our specials to go with wine. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good point. You know, using spinach with wine dishes is very, it's difficult oftentimes, but the particular Bloomsdale is sensational. And then we finish it with little pieces of Mangelista pork belly that is pan-seared, little double lardones, I call them. Mm-hmm. They're not the thin ones, they're double wide, and fresh chives. And that particular combination with a spectacular glass of Sauvignon Blanc, for example, is over the top as a first course. It's one of my favorite first courses.
And you do that pairing.
We do that pairing.
Nice. Now, for those of us who don't have that amazing pork belly, when you say lardon,
yes,
can
yes.
you use good thick bacon?
You could absolutely look any great bacon, and we have many great bacons out here that are sensational. You buy it either in a chunk, so you can cut it into thick. And when I say thick, I'm talking like, think of it in your mind, a 4x4 piece of wood. So this particular thing would be about probably close to a third of an inch by a third of an inch by the length of the bacon itself.
Okay.
So it's like a little baton.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a true lardone. And then a double wide is you do a third by two-thirds by the one and a half inch of the bacon. And pan sear it quickly in a pan to get it crispy on all four sides.
So let's talk again about the market meetup, the dates, and how you sign up.
So November the 10th, you can call Michael's restaurant. It's $60. You come and meet at the restaurant. We do our fabulous little famous cinnamon buns. You have double espressos or cappuccinos. Then we come down to the market. We do all of the shopping that we normally do for the restaurant. We then go back to the restaurant, probably around 10:30 now, and then Chef Mikey prepares, in this particular case, will be the Nantucket-based scallops with the parsnip puree in Bloomsdale, Evangelista pork lardons.
And now the customers, do they get to help cook, or are they at this point just drinking wine?
They're drinking wine at this point.
Okay. All right, Michael, as always, thank you so much. Wonderful to see you. You are on fire, as always, and thanks for all the great work you do. When you put the word chocolate in front of everything, it's always going to sound really, really irresistible. Jeff Rieger from Penryn Specialty Orchard, up in Penryn, which is near Sacramento, has the only, quote, chocolate persimmons that we have in the market. Now, Jeff will explain to us why he calls them chocolate, why they got to be known as chocolate. But, Jeff, describe to us what these persimmons are, how they look, how they taste, and the two varieties that you bring in.
Well, that's a tall order. I actually have, I don't mean to contradict you, I actually have three varieties of chocolate persimmons. The Surunoko, or Child of the Stork, which is a pointier type, looks more like a hachia. I have the Maru, which we have nicknamed Cinnamon, so just basically so people can remember what they bought the week before, which is looks more like a Fuyu, and the Hyakume, which is a kind of a tan yellowish variety, comes in a little bit later, which we have called brown sugar, and I believe the nurseries are starting to call them brown sugar.
Now, when you refer to a Hachia as opposed to a Fuyu, let's describe those two characteristics so people can spot that.
All right. Well, the Hachia persimmon is the persimmon that has to be completely soft and gooey for it to be non-astringent. The Fuyu persimmon can be eaten hard. When properly pollinated, they can have a little bit of astringency to them. Variant persimmons are not astringent, and they're going to be brown inside, so don't get scared. Mm-hmm. When you bite into them, a lot of people go, oh my God, it's rotten. Some people like them hard, and some people like to wait for them to be creamy soft like warm butter. They are super sweet this year. The spring weather that hurt some of the other crops in California really, really helped the persimmons, and they are fabulous.
All righty, Jeff. Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jeff Rieger. His orchard is in Penryn. It's called Penryn Orchard Specialties. He comes to the Wednesday Santa Monica. He's got three varieties of these so-called chocolate or cinnamon persimmons. He also makes those wonderful dried hachias called a hoshigaki. Next Thursday, November 4th, is going to be our final library panel of the season. We're very excited. The topic is organic, certified organic. What does that mean? We will have a certified organic producer, a formerly certified organic farmer, and then we'll have a farmer who was never certified. Each one of them grows delicious, natural fruit, and it's going to be an interesting discussion to talk about these various levels of certification. Also, the chef will be Neil Frazier from Grace and BLD, and he'll be serving up some wonderful treats from the Farmers Market Produce. It's going to be at the Martin Luther King Main Auditorium at the Santa Monica Library, Thursday, November 4th, from 7 till 9 p.m. on a first-come, first-seated basis. Hope to see you there. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Photos of the produce we talked about, along with a recipe, is at kcrw.com/goodfood. About a month ago, Joel Grover, a reporter for NBC here in L.A., revealed fraudulent activity by some produce vendors at farmers markets. They were selling items that they claimed to have grown, but didn't. I'm now joined by David Karp, a pomologist with UC Riverside. He writes the Market Watch column for the L.A. Times, and he thinks some changes need to be made to improve the system. I asked David to explain what happened and to go into some detail as to exactly how something like this could happen.
There are many degrees of connection. In some cases, you are actually buying from the person who was on a tractor that morning or the day before. In other cases, it's their wife or their family, which is fine, or their employees, which is less ideal, but it's still totally understandable. They can't all be on a tractor and selling at the same time. But then there are also different degrees. There are second certificates where they're selling for a neighbor. And then finally, and this is the part we're concerned with, those instances in which they're actually buying the produce that they claim to be growing themselves. Now, why would they do that, you ask? Well, they're cashing in on the cachet of locally grown, organic, small farms. Everybody wants to be buying that kind of produce at farmers markets these days, and they're willing to pay a premium for it. However, commercial produce is available cheaply, in most cases at a fraction of the price. So that offers substantial incentive for cheaters to exploit that dichotomy and to bring produce that they haven't grown.
Just to be a devil's advocate for a moment, let's just use apples as an example.
Sure.
If an apple farmer has all of his apples already are being sold at farmers markets, and he needs more apples, and he buys from another farmer that is in Southern California to sell his apples, why would that be bad? Why is that considered to be a fraud?
Well, why is it a fraud if you're buying, say, a Rolex watch or a Prada gown, and instead you're actually buying something that's a counterfeit? Or if you're buying olive oil and you think that it's pure olive oil, but in fact it's actually partly cheaper adulterated oils, what part of fraud do we wish to be complicit with? It's a lie to the consumer, and in many cases, those vendors who are willing to lie about that are also willing to lie about other things. For example, if they're claiming that their produce is organic, do you think that they actually spend more money to buy organic produce? We know that's actually not been the case. They've been selling non-organic produce. It undercuts the very core concept of farmers markets when somebody's peddling, let's use that phrase, for buying produce not of their own production and claiming that it is theirs. That's the direct connection, a farmer who grows the produce selling direct to the consumer. And knowing what variety it was, how it was farmed, how it's been stored, that's really key. And once you go down that slippery slope and start allowing them to buy from one neighbor, I guess you can make allowances for that. But then they're buying from a packing house. They're buying from a wholesale center. And as you can tell, I'm passionate about this because I love farmers markets.
Has anyone thought about that market managers should have to be certified?
Yes. A group of Southern California certified farmers market managers recently met at Tenorelli Orchards in Little Rock in the Antelope Valley, the high desert. And we're discussing that, but they've been discussing it for some time. And certainly that's a great idea because a lot of farmers market managers just don't realize how to pay attention to integrity, what to look for, what are the signs of a cheater, what are the questions to ask, what to look for in a certificate. You know what? It's like shooting a fish in a barrel at a lot of farmers markets. I can just walk down the row and I can see things that the average public customer could not. And just say, no, you did not grow those cherries in Fallbrook, North San Diego County, and have them for 3 months, and now it's August. Forget about it. There are three ways that an inspector could realize what's going on and catch cheaters. One would be from tips, whether it could be from competing farmers, and of course you have to take that with a grain of salt. Second would be collating load sheets, just figuring out how the production of a farmer corresponds to their sales. And third would be to do systematic audits, to actually go to the farm and see what's there at the same time that cooperating eyes are on the farmer's market.
Are there enough farmers in California growing enough to supply all the markets that want them?
Probably not. And if all the cheaters were caught and expelled or suspended for 18 months, the supply would decrease dramatically.
Really? By how much do you think the supply would decrease? 20%?
You know, I've never said this publicly, but I thought 10 years ago when I was working for the LA Times that maybe a quarter of all the produce vendors in Southern California certified farmers markets were cheaters. Now I'd say it's closer to 50%.
You're kidding.
No, I am not. And I'm very sorry to say this, but this is based on my traveling around to over 100 certified farmers markets around Southern California and making careful notes of who's there and who they do business with on a second certificate basis. And then gathering information from various different managers.
So if the farmers market system in Southern California were absolutely run with purest of pure integrity, we would see fewer farmers and prices would therefore go up.
Very likely in the short term that would be the case. But in the long term, it would act as a substantial incentive to honest farmers. There are a lot of honest farmers who have gotten out of the business or who do not go to certain farmers markets who say, I cannot possibly compete with these cheaters. And that's just horrifying to anybody who cares about farmers markets. And it's not just to people who are involved in the farmers markets world. It's to anybody who buys at farmers markets because you, Mr. and Mrs. Consumer, are being defrauded if you're buying produce under fraudulent pretenses. That's why we're holding 4 listening sessions. The local one is going to be in Santa Monica on November 1st from 5:30 to 7:30 at the public library. And I encourage listeners to be there and hear what's going on, and voice your opinion if you so desire.
Who's going to be running the listening sessions? Who'll be there?
The California Department of Food and Agriculture will be holding those listening sessions, and there will be managers, farmers, vendors, and those who care about farmers' markets.
And are they there to hear from the audience?
And to speak themselves. You will have the opportunity to make your opinion heard.
Thank you so much, David. I love hearing your passion.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed speaking to you, Evan.
Amelia Saltzman joins me today in the studio. She's the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, and you frequently hear her on the Market Report. Amelia also is a member of the California Certified Farmers Market Advisory Committee. I thought she'd be a good person to give us a little background on how farmers markets work here in California.
Farmers markets, as we know them, really began in the late 70s with the Direct Marketing Act that allowed farmers to sell directly to consumers.
And what's interesting, what I think a lot of people don't really understand, is that the Farmers Market Program has been this phenomenally successful, underfunded enterprise. So where does the money come from?
The money comes from, primarily the money comes from a 60-cent stall fee that each farmer pays. And there has been a desire to raise that fee for enforcement purposes. In other words, to pay for additional inspections and so on.
So the thing that fascinates me is, okay, every farmer pays 60 cents at every market they go to for each stall they have. So this is statewide a total of something like $220,000.
Right. It's
crazy.
It's a drop in the bucket.
So if they doubled that and everybody paid $1.20.
I have heard farmers who really care. Again, it all comes back to desire, knowledge, and funding. But farmers who really care about this system would pay four times that if they thought it would really help to have good enforcement, because they have a vested interest, just like every customer does, in the protection of the integrity of this system. I mean, the whole idea, the regulations are there. The idea is to protect the customer and the farmer. So if there's a cheater, it's hurting the farmer.
Thank you so much, Amelia.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I hope we did a little to untangle this challenging situation.
I'd love to hear what you think about what's happened. Did the NBC report on farmers markets affect your shopping habits? Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up after this short break, an eating tour of Bogota, Colombia. Stay tuned. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. Last week, Good Food producer Harriet Ells flew down to Bogota, Colombia to represent KCRW at a radio conference. But because she's as obsessed with food as I am, her trip quickly became more of a culinary journey.
Bogota is in the Andes. It's more than 8,000 feet above sea level. And while the cuisine definitely reflects its mountainous location, there's also a ton of food from the coast and from the country's tropical forests. Like most Latin American countries, corn dominates the food. But you won't find tortillas here. Instead, you'll find a thick, pancake-like arepa, which is the starch of choice. Chef Francisco Pinzon is the chef and owner of a restaurant called Local, or Local. I asked him about all the different types of arepas that you can find in Colombia.
Básicamente, la diferencia está en el tipo de maíz.
Basically, the difference is in the type of corn and the process, depending on what kind of corn you're dealing with. There's white corn and yellow corn. With yellow corn, it's ground with lime powder and with ash that gives it a smoky flavor. And that's what gives us the different kind of arepas, depending on what part of the country you're in.
Eso es lo que nos da como las variedades de arepa de acuerdo a la región del país.
When I landed in Bogota, I saw the requisite McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts, pizza restaurants, something you would find probably in any bustling city. But I wanted to find out what Colombians ate, not only what they ate, but how they ate. So I asked Medium. She was one of my hosts on Radio Nacional.
Se respetan las tres comidas, el desayuno en la mañana.
She says that Colombians start the day with a light breakfast, but lunch is really the big meal of the day. Rice, meat, plantains, potatoes, arepas, and vegetables. And dinner is usually pretty light. It might just be an arepa and some cheese. Oh yeah, the cheese. So there was cheese everywhere, and not just in the arepas, but it was stuffed into plantains, it was in rolls. My favorite was the pan de bono. It's a yeast roll filled with cheese. There was also the pan de yuca, which is a bread made with a yuca flour. It had kind of like a tough crust, and of course it was filled with cheese. They also serve a lot of hot soups and stews in Bogota. Chef Pinzon told me that sancocho, which is a soup made from broth, potatoes, and meat, might best represent Colombian cuisine.
Digamos que es de hace unos 5 años para acá estamos en la búsqueda.
It's been really difficult to find it. For example, the Peruvians have claimed ceviche as their contribution to the world cuisine. We Colombians have had a tougher time finding ours. But for me personally, it's sancocho. It was originally a Spanish dish. Now in Colombia, you get it with fish on the coast, with ribs in the interior, and with chicken in the Cauca Valley. It's cooked with potatoes or various tubers and whatever other meat you want to add. But let's just say that we chefs haven't been able to agree which is our national dish. Empanadas and arepas are really typical of our region, too.
Other people have said that ajiaco could also be called the national dish. That's a soup made with three different kinds of potatoes, chicken, and large chunks of corn on the cob. Now, Colombia is also known for its incredible variety of fruit. I went to the giant Peloquemao market in Bogota, where I saw fruits that I had never seen or heard of before. I talked to Dan Moen. He's an American biologist studying frogs in Colombia on a Fulbright. He's also a foodie, and he's taken a particular interest in Colombian fruit.
If you go to the markets, you can often find a huge diversity of fruits, many things that I haven't ever seen outside of the country. And so this includes something like a guama, which is a coastal fruit, and it's a big pod, almost looks like a green bean on the outside, but you split it open. On the inside, there are these huge seeds that are covered with sort of a soft, sweet pulp, white pulp, to something like passion fruits, in which I've seen in the markets here 5 different species of passion fruits. Some of them, like maracuya and golupa, are really acidic, and they're best for making in juices. On the other hand, there is granadilla, which is something that you can open up and is really sweet and delicious, and you can eat it straight. Other kinds of fruits that are, you know, really different include zapote, guanabana, anon, and chirimoya. And these are all fruits that are closely related, so they have a similar flavor but very different textures. And it's hard to describe exactly what that flavor is, but again, these are things that you can come, you can look for, you can find them in the market, and they're really delicious.
So like any major city, there is, of course, imported produce. I even saw a plum from California on a street vendor's cart. But more and more, Colombians are taking pride in their indigenous ingredients and national cuisine. Of course, there still is pizza, there's still burgers, there's still fast food. Local, Chef Pinzon's restaurant, it's an upscale cafe serving only Colombian dishes. No Italian or French items on the menu at all. It's a trend that's catching on big time in Bogota, and as a visitor, I was thrilled to be able to check it out, and I can't wait to find some Colombian restaurants here in LA. For Good Food, this is Harriet Ells. Pictures from Harriet's trip to Bogota, Colombia are at kcrw.com/goodfood. What's your dream food destination? I asked some of you on Facebook where you'd like to go, and answers ranged from Vietnam to New York City. Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Colombia, tierra querida, himno de fe y armonía. Cantemos, cantemos todo, grito de paz. Speaking of Facebook, this Monday, November 1st, I'm going to be giving away a cookbook every hour. Be the first person to answer a trivia question, and you'll win a cookbook. So this Monday, November 1st, join me on my Facebook fan page beginning at 10 a.m. And just a note, you can only win once, so play wisely.
Tomorrow is Halloween, the spookiest of holidays. Did you know that Los Angeles is home to many haunted eateries? Well, it's true. Richard Carradine has investigated over 200 haunted locations, many of them right here in Los Angeles. Richard, I understand you're speaking to us from a Starbucks. We haven't discerned whether or not it's haunted, though, right?
No, we haven't.
Are there a lot of haunted sites in Los Angeles?
Yes, there are lots of them, surprisingly. I guess not so surprisingly, considering we have kind of a very rich and sort of tragic history.
Yeah, a lot of sordid, strange history.
I do this thing once a month where we meet for cocktails and food at haunted places around the city every 13th of the month. And when I first started doing it, people would say, like, how long is this going to last? You know, how many can you possibly do? And we've now been doing it for 2.5 years every month, and it looks like there's going to be no shortage of haunted restaurants in the city.
That's incredible, and it's never been repeated. Now, give me a couple examples of some places that have been haunted for generations.
Well, there's a restaurant on Alvera Street called La Golondrina. I think I'm butchering the pronunciation, but it originally was a farmhouse. I guess Alvera Street used to be called Vine Street because of all the vintners on that street. And there's a case where it was a house back in the, I guess, late 1800s. And, it's been there ever since, and now it's a restaurant.
And who haunts it?
Well, actually, it's got two ghosts. One is the woman who opened the restaurant back in the 1920s, which is said to be the first Mexican restaurant in Los Angeles. Not that it's the first restaurant to serve that kind of food, but the first restaurant to actually call it Mexican food. But there was an old woman who opened the restaurant, and people still see her to this day wandering around the dining room and the kitchen and whatnot. And in addition to that, there's a young lady that's been seen upstairs, because the house is pretty much still intact the way it was generations ago. So if you go upstairs in the restaurant, you'll find still the bedrooms and the halls as you would a normal farmhouse. And up there, employees claim to have seen a very young woman, like early 20s, who in a flowing dress, who wanders up and down the hallways and has been seen in the bedrooms. Nobody knows exactly who she is or what her connection is to the restaurant, but sightings of her are fairly common. There's a restaurant in Silver Lake that's called the Edendale Grill. It used to be a fire station in a former life, and they claim, in addition to a whole bunch of other ghosts, that there are these things that they call shadow people, which are like, shadows on the wall that move around. And, some people say that those are a little more malicious, that they have an intelligence, unlike the other ghosts that I just talked about.
Now, when we think of restaurants that have been around forever, like Chasen's, which is now Bristol Farms, are those haunted?
It's funny you mentioned Chasen's, because yes, Chasen's does claim to be haunted. If you go there and you talk to the staff, they will tell you that they see people in very fancy, formal outfits wandering the halls of the aisles of the supermarket, from another era.
Give me some more examples of some haunted restaurants.
Well, one of my favorite restaurants is also haunted, Philippe's Downtown, creators of the French Dip Sandwich. If you go to their website, it'll tell you that it was formerly a boarding house, which is sort of a very diplomatic description of what it used to be. that area was the red light district a long time ago. And that building was apparently a fairly well-known bordello within that district. A lot of people don't realize, but there's dining area on the second, a dining area on the second floor. And if you do take your sandwiches and go up there, you will see the layout of the way it originally was, with the hallways and the rooms off to the sides. And the employees there claim that late at night they'll see a very well-dressed woman kind of strutting up and down those halls. It's believed that she was perhaps the madam of the house.
It's fascinating.
It's funny. These are a lot of places that, like, these restaurants, the stories are well-known within the employees and the staff, but are not really well-known outside of the restaurant.
Is Yamashiro haunted?
It is said to be haunted, yes. By the, I guess the original owners are buried in, up on one of the patios.
That's horrible. I didn't know that.
Apparently,
oh my gosh.
I mean, this was obviously long time ago, but they wanted to be buried on their land, and so they buried them in the back of the house, what is now one of the, I guess, the patios for the restaurant. People have claimed to see a man, a well-dressed man, walking around the restaurant, presumably one of the original owners.
It seems that many ghosts in Los Angeles that you're describing are very well-dressed.
I think it's well-dressed to our eyes. It's probably very casual to another era. Because I think people, you know, in the 30s normally dressed, you know, wore suits and hats and whatnot.
What about places like Musso and Frank's?
Yes, Musso and Frank's, you know, like I said, it's funny. Haunted places are generally historic places and vice versa. If you have a historic restaurant in the town, you know, they're more likely than not going to be ghost stories connected. And Musso and Frank's is a good example of that. It's kind of funny because a lot of people have seen a lot of different celebrity ghosts wandering through there. You know, ranging from, I think somebody saw Errol Flynn in there to somebody claimed to have seen Orson Welles in there. So it's funny that even in, you know, even now, these celebrities seem to still visit that restaurant.
I just love that even the ghosts in L.A. are so L.A.
And, you know, what's funny also is that there's like a little restaurant that's part of the Vogue Theater Complex that's next door to Musso and Frank's. And apparently they have the what was the original bar of Musso and Frank's. From what I understand, Musso and Frank's at one point went the other direction, and they had, their bar room was up against the theater. And then at some point they did a renovation, they closed that down, and they put their bar on the other side of the restaurant. So even the restaurant next door, which was where the original bar room was, claims these ghosts as well. I guess they don't realize that the bar has moved, so they're going to the, you know, the old location.
This has been so much fun. Thank you very much, Richard.
Sure. Thank you.
A list of the places that Richard mentioned is at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you're not up to getting your spook on, I suggest that you go apple picking. Delilah Snell is the owner of the Road Less Traveled store in Santa Ana, and she's also a master preserver. Last weekend, she went up to the hills of San Bernardino County to pick apples.
Hello, this is Delilah Snell, and I'm here at Willowbrook Farm with Cheryl Swanson. How long have you been at Willowbrook Farms?
Well, we moved here about 8 years ago. We opened up the business after our first year, and we've been direct marketing the apples ever since.
I had overheard while we were picking some apples that these trees are 100 years old. Is that true?
That's correct. We actually bought the orchard from the granddaughter of the man who planted the trees, Blackie Wilshire, and so they are 100 years old this year.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, so it's kind of a birthday party, too.
Yes, this is a big year.
I also overheard that last year there were no apples on the farm.
That's correct. It was kind of a sad year for us. We got very, very cold in the winter, down to 17 degrees. The blooms hadn't even opened, but it was so cold that it damaged them, and they weren't even open. So we lost our whole crop last year for the first year in many years.
Oh, wow. Yes. So they're pretty particular fruit.
The stamen wine saps in particular are, because they're one of the varieties that blooms first. So we're always worried in the spring about the temperature, because they are very delicate when they're open. Then they are picked last. So we have a big time frame where things can happen to them. We can have a hailstorm, which would damage them. So they're just a little pickier of an apple, but they're really worth the wait. They're really very good.
Is there a favorite way that you like to cook apples?
Well, I think probably one of the favorites around here is our apple crisp. It's really an easy recipe. It just turns out wonderful every single time. The particular variety of apple is a really well-known apple for baking with, because it doesn't get mushy when you bake with it. It holds its texture and holds its shape. And so a lot of people like particularly to bake with this apple.
One thing I was noticing, too, as I was picking apples, and it might have to do with the cold air, is how crisp and cold It's almost like they're in the refrigerator, the apples are. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about the taste of these particular varieties?
Absolutely. Well, this is called a sweet tart apple. So it's kind of, it's not as sweet as a Red Delicious. It's not as tart as a Granny Smith's, kind of in the middle, almost along the lines of a Macintosh. But the wine saps are known for having having that crispness that you mentioned and the juiciness. When we press cider with these apples, we get a lot more cider per apple because of the juiciness. And actually, this week is a really great week to come up and pick them because we've had cold weather, and the cold weather turns the starches to sugar. And so actually, they like this cold weather, and it has made our apples even better.
How long is the season for picking apples?
Well, that's a great question. We start in October. This is a later picking variety, and we usually finish up sometime towards the beginning of November. Typically, we'll have a frost in November, and that'll kind of soften the apples up, and they're not quite as good, and that usually is what ends our season, is our first snow or first frost.
Cheryl, it was a pleasure speaking to you, and we just loved it here at Willowbrook Farms. It's quite magical.
Well, we are very honored that you've come, and we hope you'll come back and visit us again.
We went a little nuts at the Willowbrook Farm, and we picked about 7 or 8 large bags of apples. We actually needed 2 people to carry. I just became a master food preserver a few years ago, and so many of these apples I'm going to use to make apple butter and an apple chutney. I'm also going to infuse some vodka with some of these apples as well. Probably my favorite application.
Up next, the newest food celebrities in L.A. are butchers. Meet them here next. That's in 1 minute here on KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I often think about what my next act would be if I decided to jump into another line of work, and I have to say that being a butcher is very appealing. When I heard that 2 women butchers were about to join the ranks of LA food specialty businesses, it excited me to learn about their journey. Amelia Posada and Erica Nakamura are Lindy and Grundy. Welcome, ladies.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
we're so excited.
So, Erica, Lindy and Grundy, are you? Do you have cartoon character alter egos?
In a certain sense, we do. I am Grundy. Amelia over here is Lindy. Basically, you know, once we got together, Amelia had told me about a imaginary childhood friend she'd had, Grundy. And, you know, she just kept telling me, you're such a Grundy, you're such a Grundy. And I had no idea what that meant. But as we kind of progressed into this, you know, fantastic relationship we do have now, you know, I very quickly became Grundy, I think, in a certain sense for her. And we had to find a girlfriend for Grundy. So, you know, Lindy happened that way.
How sweet.
Yeah.
Now, both of you were living in New York for a long period of time. How did you decide to come out to L.A. to open your business?
You know, a couple years ago or so, Amelia and I were visiting her folks here in L.A., and we were looking for a really fantastic cut of meat. And before we knew it, we were scratching our heads going, where is this? Like, we can't find anything in L.A. And that was somewhat of a disappointment, but at the same time, very inspirational. You know, it was butchering was something that was already kind of in my future, and at the same time, I think she and I realized this was this wide open market. And, you know, also Amelia's from here. And so she gets to be with her family and I get to join in on the fun.
You're both ex-vegetarians. And Amelia, you were and still are a floral designer for 12 years before you got into this business. What made each of you decide to go into the butchering business?
Well, here's the story. So Erica had gone to culinary school at the French Culinary Institute, and she started working the line at lots of different restaurants in New York, and she just decided it wasn't for her. She didn't like working the line. The hours were too much for her, and we had really opposite schedules because I would work in the morning, and I was working for a florist on the Upper East Side doing flowers for the St. Regis, places like that. So when she decided to take this apprenticeship, I said, you know, I'm going to go with you up to Woodstock and I'll plan our wedding in the cabin while you go off to butchering. And 2 weeks into the program, she quickly realized that this was her calling. And all of the butchers at Fleischer's Meats in Kingston, New York, where we both apprenticed, they said that she was very talented and that if she wanted to open up a butcher shop, she better get her wife on board. So I picked up a knife.
And went to work. Yep.
Erica, what was it about butchery that just fit you like a glove?
The number one thing that always attracted me to butchering is that with my background in sculpture, actually, it's very subtractive.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I have a degree in visual arts from Antioch College in Ohio. And the, you know, along with the economy kind of crumbling, it's such a challenge for college educated people to actually have a nice job, you know? And in the process of all of that, I brought myself into culinary school. And right when I started working with meat, I would just shoot up in the middle of the night and go, Amelia, oh my gosh, I want to be a butcher. And she's going, oh, yeah, sweetie. Okay, go to bed. And this kept happening over and over. And I just started to develop this very romantic relationship with the art of butchering.
Did you have a moment where you realized that focusing on sustainable meat was the only way you wanted to present it?
Yes, absolutely. I think partially the fact of the matter is that the old school craft of butchering has just been wiped off the face of the earth. I don't know what happened. You know, I guess, you know, industrialism happened. And so in the course of all of that, you know, I've always been a big fan of these neighborhood, small family-owned businesses. And the combination of those two things, and I started working at a neighborhood butcher shop in Brooklyn, they really focused a lot on sustainability. So that's really where I started to learn more about it. And before I knew it, you know, eating locally and sustainably became this thing that Amelia and I were both completely obsessed with. You know, it was something that it's a contribution that we felt like we could make to our community.
I understand that you had a tour of the Walmart meat processing area.
Absolutely.
With a really experienced butcher.
Absolutely. His name was Hans Sebald. He used to run the meat program at the Culinary Institute of America. He works for Fleischer's at the moment. And one of the things he does do within your first week is he takes you to Walmart. And you stand with him in the frozen food section and in the meat section, freezing, you know, and going through the ingredients. And it's just mind-boggling to see that something as natural as meat has ingredients. So you start going through the list of ingredients and you see, you know, preservatives, you see flavorings, you know, all sorts of kind of chemical compositions that really are mind-boggling, I think. And so that was very eye-opening for both of us. And Amelia, actually, that day changed her, I think, for the rest of her life, maybe.
When Erica first invited me to come learn how to become a butcher at Fleischer's, it was not an easy decision for me. I was a vegetarian for 14 years, and I started eating meat about 4 years ago. And I'm also kind of a squeamish person. I didn't have any formal training, you know, as a chef or in a kitchen ever. I wear bright red lipstick every day, pearl earrings, and I'm super girly. So when I walked into Fleischer's and they wanted me to cut this head off of a lamb, I was just taken aback. I had never seen anything like this before. And so they said, it's time for you to go to Walmart today. So they took me to Walmart, Hans Sebald, master butcher. And I stood for 3 hours in the meat section with him, and he talked to me about, you know, the factory farming industry and the state of food. And I left literally in tears that day, seeing the people that's all that they can afford, that's all they have access to in communities. This is their only option. And it broke my heart. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go take that lamb's head off right now. I'd rather do that than ever step foot in the section again.
I understand that neither Nyman nor Jidori will be in your shop. That's a really interesting choice. Why?
Well, I'd like to speak up about the Jidori. We were planning on carrying Jidori chickens, but the people that we were going to be buying them from wouldn't let us come visit their farm. To me, that's a deal breaker. So we're on to sourcing some good local chicken. And definitely not Nyman. It's too big for us. We only want to support small family farms. And we've got some really good ranchers that we'll be working with in the Lompoc area.
One of the things that I also wanted to say about Nyman Ranch in general is that, you know, they do have a fantastic product, I think. And in Los Angeles, you see Nyman everywhere in Los Angeles. One of the things that we want to do is, yes, we want to work with small family farms. We also don't want to work with people who are too small because we don't want to exhaust their herds. So there's a line with sustainability. You know, you have to give and take a little bit. And so that's definitely a big part of our commitment, is to make sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Erica and Amelia are Lindy and Grundy. Their shop on Fairfax North of Melrose will be opening in early December. Did that put you in the mood to eat some meat? Well, coming up in just a few seconds, Jonathan Gault takes us out for a burger. Stay tuned. This is KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. I love when Jonathan Gault stops by because that means we're going to be tempted. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins us here every week. Today, we're going to Canoga Park for a burger.
The name of the place is Douglas Burger. Not Douglas Burger, not Douglas Burger, Douglas Burger.
Is there a person named Douglas?
There may be, or there may have been at one time. There must have been. Why else would you name it that?
And what are the hallmarks of this burger place?
The hallmarks, as anybody who has grown up in the West Valley in the last 50 years will tell you, are the French fries. Whenever people, or at least people of a certain ilk, talk about the best French fries in L.A., Douglas Burger was always a place that comes up. And I'd never actually been there until recently.
And did they live up to their hype?
They were certainly exemplary of a type.
And what type is that?
They are the French fries that, if you grew up here, you remember from 1965.
And what are those?
They are real potatoes cut, fried twice, but these aren't Belgian fries, right? I mean, there's nothing fancy about them. These are, it's almost as if they're fried twice, not just to get that sort of styrofoamy texture that you get in In-N-Out fries away, to make them extra double greasy. so that each fry like sort of like curls up like a caterpillar and has a presence of its own. And when you're contemplating Douglas fries, you're not contemplating a single fry. You are at a place where a large order of fries, and I don't know why you'd get a large order of fries except as a dare or if you have 10 people with you, comes out on like a cafeteria play, like heaped like a freaking Alp with these fries, you know, all smelling great, all super greasy, all curled in different ways. Some will be crisp, some won't be crisp. You know, some will be incinerated, some will be almost raw, and you do that. Well, they won't be raw because they've been pre-cooked, but you do that wonderful sort of, how do you call it? French fry triage.
Yes.
Which is to say that you go through this pile of fries and you pick one that you think is going to be the fry that's going to have the exact ratio of crunch to squish. And maybe that'll be fry and maybe that won't be the fry. Then you get all the fries that you think are going to be perfect and you're left with the less perfect fries and then they've started to cool so the level goes even lower and then you do the triage anymore and then you find you're so full that you have to go to a nearby hospital in Winnetka and get your stomach pumped. But you have had the Douglas experience.
But most people choose to only have the fries or do they have a burger to accompany this French fry foraging?
Usually, probably you would order a hamburger. And with the hamburger comes only like an incredibly immoderate amount of fries instead of a truly stupefying amount of fries.
And is the burger something to write home about or is it sort of an afterthought to the fries?
Well, the slogan of the restaurant is where every day is fry day. But the burgers are fine. I mean, it's the Los Angeles fast food burger, right? I mean, the meat is not quite luscious. It's kind of stiff. There is not somebody lovingly back there getting, you know, prime aged chuck and hand patting it. I mean, this is a, you know, deal 'em like cards kind of hamburger, but it's good because of that. They do also the Los Angeles standard pastrami burger, which is probably the way to go. I mean, if you're going to do a job, do a job. Let your arteries know who's boss.
Okay.
I think the restaurant is Greek owned, or at least it seems to be Greek owned. There's a mural in the what passes for a dining room of looks like the view of the sea, of the Ionian Sea from a Greek island with the cat in the foreground.
So is there tzatziki to dip your french fries into?
You can get tzatziki to dip your french fries
really?
Into.
Really? Oh, can. I love that.
And you can get a gyro that is not the gyro that you want, but sometimes the gyro that you want is the gyro that's right in front of you. And in that case, you're in luck.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
We've been talking about Douglas Drive-In on Van Owen Street and Winnetka in Canoga Park. Get the exact address sent directly to your phone by texting the words good food to 69866. That's good food to 69866. All of Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions are also on our Good Food restaurant map. It's on the blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Earlier this month, I got a chance to speak to a legendary cookbook author, Paula Wolfert. I caught up with her at the first annual Couscous Festival. Yes, there is now a festival devoted to couscous. Paula's the author of many cookbooks, and she specializes in the Mediterranean cuisine and the food of Morocco. You have a really personal relationship with North Africa. You lived for quite a while.
7 years. I had a choice. My husband just graduated from college, and he had won a scholarship to one of those places in Iowa to be a writer. But we were part of the Beatniks revolution, not the hippies. This was before the hippies. See how old I am. And it was a chance to join people like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and Paul Bowles and Jane Bowles in Tangier. So I didn't, as a food person, I did not go to Tangier or to Morocco for the food. And to quote somebody else, I was misinformed.
Now, I know that while you were there, your intro into the real stuff were the women that cooked for you in the house.
I had an extraordinary experience, which never happens again, but I thought that's how you wrote cookbooks. The king of Morocco, Mohammed Cinq, who was the late grandfather of the present king, had a cook in Rabat who had retired. And her son lived in New York. And he asked his mother if she would teach me everything she knew. This is what's called the Dada, the woman who runs the kitchen. And she was in retirement. He got the Moroccan government to pay for it all. They flew me over. I moved in with her. She didn't speak anything but Arabic. And I lived with her for 6 weeks. And we cooked every day. We cooked a few dishes, and people came to lunch in either French or English and told me stories and history of the dishes and history of everything. After the 6 weeks, the government put me in a car. A man was assigned to drive me throughout the whole country to the top gastronomical sites where the mayor of the town was asked to produce the best cook and teach me the recipe. I swear to God, I thought this is how you wrote cookbooks.
So here we are, 40 years later, and you still are writing about Moroccan food. In fact, it's the subject of your new book.
As it should be, because when I wrote that book, no one had ever heard of a tagine. I had to put everything into Le Creuset pots. I was very faithful to the recipes, except I had to add water and I had to restructure the recipes so that they would fit into American pots. That's not true anymore. Now people have traveled. They know what it's really supposed to taste like. And I went back and I measured and figured out, but I did something more. I found 150 new recipes, most of them up in the mountains from the Riffian people, fabulous dishes that have never been written in English, so it was fun. Plus, I found new ways of making warka, this wonderful pastry that's like a brick pastry, but I do it with a paintbrush. I mean, it's so easy, and it's stronger than phyllo, it's thinner than phyllo, and it bakes up more tender than phyllo. Plus, rolling your own couscous, plus a number of other things that I just wasn't able to attend to because none of the ingredients were available in the United States. Everything's available in the United States, and everybody's been traveling now. They know what's good. They know the real thing. So it's a joy to rewrite your own history.
So let's talk for a minute about clay pot cooking. What is it about the clay itself that gives a different result, or does it?
Well, it depends whether it's been glazed or not. Unglazed, you have the taste of the earth. That you hear that about the word terroir all the time. Well, when you cook in an unglazed pot, for example, down in Santa Fe, Felipe Ortega's pots, when you cook beans in one of his unglazed pots, which you can buy in Santa Fe, I mean, the beans sing. If they could. I mean, it's so delicious compared to cooking it in either metal or in a glazed pot. It is a coddling effect. It goes two ways. And it's the even cooking in clay.
And when you say it goes both ways, you mean that because the unglazed clay is porous,
it wicks off moisture and it also gives aroma. There is a difference, but it's not always good for everything. But I mean, if you make your yogurt the way they do
In Greece.
It's always in an unglazed pot. Why? It wicks off the extra moisture, and all of a sudden you have this incredibly thick, creamy yogurt. But it's not just North Africa or Middle East. I mean, also Asia is like this. The Koreans and the Japanese have fabulous clay. The Chilean, but the Colombian is fabulous. Beautiful pots. They're, and those are unglazed, and they really play a role in the taste of the food and the presentation. You forget about the presentation. And also, it's all one-pot cooking. There is a difference between that and the crock pot. Because of the shallowness, there is an evaporation of moisture, which allows a certain caramelization, a certain development of flavors that doesn't happen, particularly in a crock pot. I mean, it's complicated. I understand there are many, many more clay pot books coming out.
Thank you, Paula. If you missed any part of today's show, you can download it or subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood. I've got a recipe there from Paula Wolfert and information on all of today's guests. Good Food is produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Bob Carlson, Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laurel Garcia. Jennifer Farrow is our consulting producer. Production help comes from Ronnie Mickelson. Gary Messiha chooses our music. Thanks so much to Becky Nelson. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.